You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at opensocietyfoundations.org.
Let me start by introducing the people who are in front of us, and then I will ask a couple of questions to get the conversation going up here. So to my far left is Steve Aftergood, who is the director of the Program on Government Secrecy at the Federation of American Scientists. Bill Leonard, the former director of the Information Security Oversight Office with a distinguished and lengthy career in the Defense Department, the Pentagon, and several advisory positions, now with the National Endowment for Democracy. To my right is B. Edwards, the current director of the Government Accountability Project, and also with quite a long background here in Washington, D.C. B can explain more about Government Accountability Project, one of the leading organizations working to defend and represent whistleblowers. In New York, our moderator is Lisa Mackerel, who is with the U.S. Programs, head of our National Security and Human Rights Campaign. And she'll be with us for the first hour or so. And to the extent that people in New York have questions, Lisa or Joel, please raise, wave your hands. And I will start with kind of just a brief introduction to note that one reason for convening this discussion now is the fact that on June 23rd, the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe rendered a vote, reached a decision that called for increased protection of national security whistleblowers, and in particular called upon all of the countries, the member states of the Council of Europe, to grant asylum to whistleblowers who were not afforded an opportunity to raise a public interest defense, and also called on the U.S. government not to prosecute Snowden unless he is afforded the opportunity for a public interest defense. So that was quite a dramatic decision. The Parliamentary Assembly is comprised of 316 parliamentarians from across the 48 states of the Council of Europe. They passed this resolution with very few dissents, and reflecting quite a consensus among the lawmakers in Europe that the public interest defense is an important ingredient of democratic accountability. So my first question goes to Anna in London to give us some background as to how did the Parliamentary Assembly get to this point, and a question that is on everybody's minds: the Parliamentary Assembly has reached this resolution. What is the practice of the Council of Europe member states? So Anna Myers is currently the expert coordinator of the Whistleblowing International Network and the incoming director of the Government Accountability Project. A long background defending and representing whistleblowers and also providing advice to governments in Europe on improving their laws and improving their practice. So Anna, let's hear from you.
It's a real pleasure to be here with you today. And I am really delighted to talk about what happened a bit last week and to give you some background to how we got to this point. I first of all to say that I think that in Europe, in some ways, in terms of the debates and the discussions, it's very open. And it is very much talking about these issues in terms of a human rights and democratic accountability framework. In terms of actual pace of change and reform, it's probably not so creative and not so advanced yet. I would say that in Europe, the issue of whistleblower protection really took off in the anti-corruption area. And the Council of Europe had two treaties, the Convention, the Criminal and Civil Law Conventions on against corruption, and in there started to put, and I think this is something that Public Concern at Work, which is the UK NGO that I was deputy director of, had some influence over, and and with PI push this agenda in Europe. And it was looking much more in the public sector, that's how they picked it up, and looked at it as a matter of good governance and putting a duty on the right civil servants to speak up about malpractice that relates not solely as to whether or not they have the power to refuse an unjust order. So it was starting to say as civil servants in Europe and starting to build the capacity, particularly in new members of both the EU and old members of the Council of Europe, to try and build up a duty to serve the public. But I think it also was being picked up at the same time as a very natural corollary to access to information and the right to free expression. So there have been cases at the European Court of Human Rights all through this period. I would say those two trajectories were brought together in the Council of Europe, but they were separated in other parts of Europe. So they were separated and not talked as much about in the European Union context, which of course is a supranational organization and has obviously more binding orders on member states to do things than the Council of Europe. But I think that the latter is becoming incredibly important now in Europe, that the idea, and this is where the Council of Europe's work over the last, I would say since 2008, has been incredibly important. Peter Omsic, the Committee on Legal Affairs and Human Rights, has been the rapporteur for three reports that I've had some links with, the first in 2009-10, which put whistleblowing very much within this accountability framework, and also started to talk about how important it was culturally when you deal with member states that have dealt with war and dictatorship and fascism, to understand whistleblowing not as informing, and also talking about it as very important even within national security fields. So it's always sort of been a neater fit, I think, I'm talking about it. But again, this was within the human rights and the democratic accountability framework at the Council of Europe. And I think those things have come together, the work that OSJI and others have done on the Schwani principles that have picked up looking at right to information, picked up on the whistleblowing. And then I think the Council of Europe did pick up on the report the Parliamentary Assembly had done in 2010, and 4 years later came up with a recommendation, which is a legal instrument that put whistleblowing much more within the framework of both public and private sector, but didn't really focus on the national security issues. And that's often been the trade-off in the European context, that we'll do whistleblower protection sort of in this other area with employment protection, but we will leave the national security piece on the side. And with the Snowden disclosures, which really pushed the agenda, and the Schwani principles, which came a bit, you know, almost were published then, simultaneously or very close to that moment, there was a real debate about privacy and the issue of surveillance. And so I think probably the Parliamentary Assembly wasn't necessarily going to look at this again so soon after having done the first report, after the Committee of Ministers had done a recommendation, which is being rolled out in Europe, and it is being picked up by the European Commission in technical projects. It does have a lot of weight in terms of actually supporting change and getting some reforms in place for whistleblowers to be able to speak up and to not have to feel that the confidentiality is greater than the public interest. And when these things came together, the report then, what the committee decided to do was separate, and they've done two reports, one on mass surveillance and one on improving protection of whistleblowers, and they definitely wanted to pick up on this issue of really focusing in on those who work with them in the national security space and to really say that this is important. And in terms of the mood in Europe, in terms of the popular mood and the mood with parliamentarians, certainly in the Council of Europe, what was fascinating about the debate was how positive it really was. It was really only the UK that tried to get some last-minute amendments in, wording like, Edward Snowden should surrender himself to US courts rather than return with the possibility of having a public interest defense. And the interesting bit in the debates were the report was very much broadly supported, and this was an amendment that was actually passed by the wider committee in the morning. There's a very short period of debate in the Parliamentary Assembly, and Peter Omsic got up and spoke even against his own committee on this amendment, because he said that just goes to the heart of this issue. Surrendering himself to the courts isn't, you know, we're trying to make sure that he has the ability to have a public interest defense and to allow him to return. And so he argued against his own committee, and the Parliamentary Assembly voted against the UK amendment to the text. So you can see that there is very much that mood in there, and there, whether it's reaching all the lawmakers and the ministries of justice and the national security people around Europe, we'll wait to see. But I think that it keeps the issue very much on the agenda and pushes the boundaries of the discussion much farther, much faster than they were even 3 years ago. And it's really interesting in a European context how much the idea that other national security agencies are able to spy on citizens of other states is taken very, very, very seriously here, and is considered a real breach of privacy and rights. So I hope that gives you some of the flavor of what has been happening. It does mean that civil society is very alive to these issues, and I think it's reopening. I think what's happening, and I would say in the UK, what is interesting is there isn't a public interest defense in the Official Secrets Act, but there's still debate as if it's somehow, there's a couple of words in there that allow it. The public interest as a legal principle and the tests and assessments are used in so many other legal ways. They're used in the Public Interest Disclosure Act, which is a piece of employment protection for whistleblowers. There is a public interest defense in the Data Protection Act in the UK. It just says the public interest. And if you think about what is involved in that, it's very much what the Schwanee principles have highlighted, and that also builds on European court cases and the case law of looking at when you would protect people who made unauthorized disclosures. I think what the debate does, and I think why it's so important that this has been said, not only because we in the whistleblower protection community will pick it up and push it and talk about it, is because it really gets the discussion about proper oversight on the table. Because if you're talking about a public interest defense, then you're talking about when that comes up and how it works. And it's prompting, I think, a greater look at proper oversight and proper channels for those working in national security to raise issues. And one final point I would say about the recommendation, which as I said was very weak on the national security bit, did say quite clearly that you couldn't carve out the actual people. They very much focused on there may be situations in which you would very much limit information. You weren't saying that people who worked in a particular place could be exempted from laws. They were acknowledging in the recommendation that there might be more limited protection for those working with classified information in very strict circumstances. And that was what the report last week really drew out and started to develop much more clearly. So it gives us a lot in Europe, different jurisdictions to work with, and to make the connections with principles that are already being applied in Europe, perhaps in different contexts.
Great, Anna, thanks very much. And you talked about the Official Secrets Act from the UK, which has had quite an impact around the world in the Commonwealth. Up until 1989, I think the case was, in fact, that there was a public interest defense in common law, and the Official Secrets Act of 1989 then said expressly there is no public interest defense, but it does include a requirement that the government prove that the disclosure was damaging, at least concerning civil servants other than those in the intelligence agency. And that has given an opportunity for lawyers to bring in the countervailing weight of the information versus the secrecy, and it's put the information in front of juries, and juries, in fact, have refused to convict in cases where the information is of high public interest. So it's an interesting dynamic to look at the countries where there still are jury trials versus those that are not.
where prosecutors have to bear in mind some of those considerations. The other point from Europe that's very exciting is the number of decisions of the European Court of Human Rights, which have affirmed the rights of whistleblowers in the national security area, intelligence area, as well as in other areas, saying that there is a free speech right of the whistleblower and that there is also a right of the public to receive information of high public interest, setting out a test as to what needs to be established. And it's quite a good set of considerations that have also been reflected in the law of Canada and in sort of the practice of the Netherlands and a few other places. So with that overview of what's happening in Europe especially, I'd like to turn to the panel here in Washington, recognizing that what happens in Europe is not of much weight here in discussions with decision makers, but that we might benefit from some of the experiences overseas and perhaps might think about conversations which we can facilitate. Also, Anna, thanks. You mentioned the Chouanet Principles on National Security and Right to Information. I do have copies of those here. These were the outcome of conversations in 14 cities around the world involving more than 500 people, civil society experts, activists, government officials, security professionals, law enforcement, coming up with consensus on 50 principles about the kinds of information that should be proactively disclosed, the kinds of information that are at the core of national security secrecy, and procedural ways and substantive ways to balance those two sometimes competing interests. So I'd like to turn to Bill Leonard and to ask you, Bill, what trends have you seen in classification, declassification decisions? Have there been changes regarding classification since Manning and Snowden? And have there been changes regarding whistleblowing in the U.S.?
Thanks, Sandy. Broadly, if you take a look at the annual report issued by the office I was formerly affiliated with, there have been some noticeable trends as of late in terms of, for example, original classification decisions over the past several years are markedly down, and even derivative classification decisions have reflected a decrease as well. In terms of trying to discern a reason why, it's rather difficult. It's like so many other things, it's probably multiple reasons why. But one of the things that I think is clearly undisputable is that overclassification still persists as almost an intractable problem. As a matter of fact, one of the things I did in preparing for our discussion this afternoon was take a look at the most recent report issued by my former office, and taking a look at, for example, declassification decisions, and I think the numbers there are rather telling. There's a provision in the executive order known as a mandatory declassification review request, and basically that's where anyone can make an access demand for a particular record. And if the government says, well, you can't have that record because it's classified, the individual can say back to the government, well, are you sure? And the government is required then to do a classification review of that. Mostly it's done for historical records, old records, but there's really no time limit assigned to it. And if you take a look at the numbers government-wide over the past almost 20 years, they've been rather consistent. So, for example, 92% of the time when somebody asks the government, are you sure that record is really classified? Government comes back and says, well, golly gee whiz, you're right. At least either all of it or some of it is no longer classified. But nonetheless, 32% of the time, there's an overlap between these two categories. 32% of the time, the government will say, but we're going to hold back either the entire document or some of the document because, yes, some of it is still classified. Well, there's a provision in the order that says, well, you can appeal that decision. So once somebody asks the question, is told, yes, we're sure it's classified, they can appeal the decision. And when they appeal the decision, the agency itself comes back and, 75% of the time says, well, you know what, golly gee whiz, you're right. That stuff really is no longer classified, either in whole or in part. But yet, nonetheless, either affirming the decision in whole or apart, 60% of the time, they nonetheless restrict some additional information. And yet there's still one more appeal left. The individual can go to what's known as the Interagency Security Classification Appeals Panel. And they can say, hey, I've asked this agency twice whether or not this stuff is really still classified. Twice they've come back, either whole or in part, and said, yes, it is. We want this interagency panel to look at it. And guess what? They come back 70% of the time and said, you know what, golly gee whiz, this stuff really shouldn't be classified anymore. And the important thing to keep in mind are these are current decisions using current standards being made by professional people trained in the standards. And yet still, the vast majority of the time, they're getting the answer wrong. Because all they have to be able to demonstrate is that this material still meets the standards for classification. It's not the question is, should this stuff be classified anymore? The question is, can this stuff be classified still after all these years? And the vast majority of the time, these trained professionals get it wrong. And if these trained professionals get it wrong, you can imagine what the rank and file millions of people with day-to-day clearances, how often they get it wrong. So the trends are undeniable. The trends are still there. They've been persistent. And it's almost intractable.
Okay, thank you. Steve, anything to add? And can you also talk about the Public Interest Declassification Board and what its mandate and powers are?
First of all, I would agree with what Bill just said. Bill is one of my mentors who I've learned a lot from, and I also bugged him when he was in office to take action, and he really did. He was a great public servant. I would change the tone of his comments slightly. Instead of golly gee whiz, I would say hooray. It's not that, oh, you know, they were classifying wrong. It's hooray, they were fixing the problem. There was someone to go to and say, this shouldn't be classified, and they said, you know, you're right, it shouldn't be, and we're gonna remove classification. That's good news. That means there is a mechanism in place to fix erroneous classification decisions. I would also say about the reduction in the number of original classification decisions. A lot of us are in the habit of mocking the Obama administration for its initial promise to be the most transparent administration ever, and how, you know, how all the ways that it has fallen short. One of the ways it has not fallen short is in the reduction in creating new secrets. The number of new secrets that are being created has dropped drastically year after year for the last 4 years to a historically low level. When Bill was the ISU director, they were generating approximately 350,000 new secrets each year. Last year, in the Obama administration, they generated 46,000. So a dramatic reduction, not just for 1 year, but for year after year. Again, that's good news. The subject of our panel, public interest. The term public interest appears in only one provision of the executive order on classification. It says that most information that fits the criteria for classification should be classified. However, even if it fits the criteria for classification, but there is a public interest in its disclosure, then it should, in these cases, the information should be declassified. So there is recognition in the executive order of the possibility that the public interest would trump classification requirements. And in fact, that provision has been invoked by the intelligence community in the post-Snowden era, where they released thousands of pages of records pertaining to intelligence surveillance. They didn't say this stuff is, you know, didn't need to be classified. They said it was properly classified. In fact, it is properly classified, but we're going to release it anyway because of the public interest in this disclosure. So it's an interesting footnote. Now, at the same time, and I should caution, I'm not a lawyer, there is no such thing as a public interest defense in U.S. law, as far as I know. And so I think the parliamentary resolution was not properly expressed in an idiom that it can be understood in the U.S. I think we all intuitively believe that the public interest context should be considered in any resolution of the Snowden case, but there isn't a what you would call a public interest defense. What there is a defense of necessity. What that means is that regardless of what the letter of the law is, sometimes the right thing to do is to violate it. You might need to take a critically ill person to the hospital and run through a red light. You violated the law when you did that, but the defense of necessity was you had to do it to save a life. You might have to break into somebody's house, which is against the law, in order to put out a fire. And so there is such a thing as a defense of necessity, and I think if you were to translate the parliamentary resolution into the American legal idiom, it would be to say Snowden should be permitted to present an argument of a necessity defense, and the government should not object. They can argue against it, as they surely would, but they should permit such a defense to be advanced. I don't think that would solve all of his problems. I think there's a necessity or a public interest argument to be made clearly with respect to the telephony metadata disclosure. It's much harder to think of a public interest defense in some of the other disclosures. The interview in the South China Morning Post where he said that, yeah, NSA is hacking China up and down, or the various disclosures of intelligence collection techniques that are now presumably reduced in effectiveness. So, you know, I think a necessity defense or a public interest defense won't solve all of his problems, but it is something that could and should be considered. I could go on, but why don't I turn it over?
Well, Steve, I just wonder, what are your thoughts as to the explanation as to this drop in the number of classification of new categories?
I agree with Bill that there are likely to be multiple factors. I discussed this question with Bill's successor, John Fitzpatrick, the current director of the Information Security Oversight Office. And he said that one of the factors he believes is the implementation of what was called the Fundamental Classification Guidance Review, which was performed under the Obama executive order in between 2010 and 2012 to eliminate obsolete classification requirements and to clarify the classification guidance that agencies produce. And so his hypothesis was that by generating clearer classification guidance, that led to the production of fewer new secrets. If that's true, which I would love to believe, then that is good news because there is another fundamental classification guidance review coming up next year to be completed by 2017, and it means that this process can be pushed further and more can be done to improve the clarity of classification guidance and to reduce the resulting production of new secrets.
Let me turn to Mort Halperin, who has just joined us, having given apologies previously for having been on an emergency phone call, senior advisor of the Open Society Foundations. Mort,
I'm going to start with a cynical comment. I think part of the explanation for there being fewer original classification decisions is what seems to be a change in the definition of when a classification is derivative or not. And the classification guidelines seem to say that if they explain the reason and the process for classifying, say, information from foreign governments, and then you classify information from a foreign government, relying on the guidance in the classification guideline, that is then treated as a derivative classification rather than an original classification.
Let me quickly interrupt you. I don't think it's cynical, but I do think it's mistaken, because in the last report, not only have original classifications gone down, so have derivative classifications. And that means if it were, it's a brilliant speculation, but I don't think it's correct. If the original classifications had been moved over into the derivative category,
we know that they have.
We know that the derivatives are also going down. Okay. In other words, there really is a net reduction in new secrets.
Okay. I withdraw the comments.
Well, moving on to B, comments about trends, but also perhaps you could address the implications of the public interest defense politically.
Thank you, Sandy, and the panel and Open Society Foundation. I did want to back up a little bit away from the courtroom and the classification and discussions specifically of public interest in a legal sense, and talk about this from the point of view of whistleblowing, more specifically, because my organization does represent whistleblowers, and so we are concerned from that point of view. For us, the issue of classification over classification, or whether the trends go up or down, is significant, because if information is classified, then it is a crime to disclose it. And when, excuse me, when a whistleblower discloses classified information, then that person could be and is exposed to criminal prosecution. And so what we've seen at Gap in the last, say, I want to say 10 years, is a trend toward the criminalization not just of national security whistleblowing, which has always been a crime, but of whistleblowing in general, that we've seen that disclosing information from different sectors, not just the national security sector, has become criminal. And we have a big poster on the wall in the conference room, which is a statement of principle, which is that it should never be a crime to report a crime, and that confidentiality or classification should not be a legitimate reason to maintain something as a secret, because I think we have seen that when you combine secrecy and power, you often get corruption and malfeasance. So as we've worked with whistleblowers, it's interesting, because in the last, say, since the year 2000, we have here in the United States achieved or a passage of a number of new whistleblower protection laws. We go kind of sector by sector. They're not freestanding pieces of legislation, but there is a whistleblower protection provision, for example, in Dodd-Frank to protect whistleblowers in the finance sector, and that was added after the financial crisis of 2008-2009. Sarbanes-Oxley also, of course, includes whistleblower protection provisions, and it was adopted after the 2001 crisis in the U.S. economy. And we are now confronting, as we strengthen whistleblower protections from a legislative point of view and a legal point of view, we also see an increasing attack on whistleblowers and a tendency to criminalize whistleblowing in more and more cases. So, for example, beyond national security, a whistleblower in finance or in the corporate world can be charged with theft for revealing proprietary information. There's a well-known case in Europe right now of Antoine Deltour, who revealed financial information about tax deals that multinational corporations had struck with the government of Luxembourg, and this is potentially the conflict. There is a crime that's being revealed, possibly, and Antoine Deltour himself has been charged with a crime. At GAP, one of our big programs, and we have a couple of representatives here, is the Food Integrity Campaign. And a number of states in the United States are criminalizing the unauthorized recording, either audio or video, of the practices of a private corporation in a food production plant. So as the protections strengthen, also it seems the attack or the offense against whistleblowing is also increasing. Having said that, then the PACE resolution, the European Parliament resolution, is a very encouraging development because it shows the extent to which European governments are acting to protect national security whistleblowers. When we were talking about the panel, and I just want to kind of throw this out there, when we were talking about the panel and how what we should address, we did discuss this kind of odd situation that is, Europe has stronger laws now to protect national security whistleblowers, or certainly a popular support of them, but there aren't any national security whistleblowers in Europe, whereas we have a long trail of them, but we are not able to protect them very well. We were encouraged, though, when we saw that Eric Holder in the last week or so suggested that Eric Snowden could come home and that perhaps there would be some kind of a deal for him. And at GAP, we're talking about maybe asking Mr. Holder to represent Edward Snowden pro bono, since I'm sure Edward Snowden cannot afford the services of the former Attorney General, which brings me to the last point about public interest defense and criminalization of disclosing information, and that is that when we talk about this conflict in a courtroom, we're really already at the end of the story. There's a lot of theater in the courtroom to promote the impression that there's an equality of power there, that there's a balance of power. So there's a judge that sits in the middle, wears an outfit, everybody has a script. You have your attorney if you're the defendant. The state prosecutor represents the state. The charging document says the government of the United States versus Edward Snowden. If you're on the wrong side of that controversy, you are in a world of pain. And we have clients who can testify to that. That is, when the apparatus of a criminal prosecution starts rolling at you, even if you are reasonably affluent and middle class, you do not have the resources to defend yourself as an equal player on that playing field. And that's why this question of the public interest defense is so important, because it does go a long way, or it goes a certain way, toward equalizing the players in the conflict. However, it also poses, I think, in answer to your original question, the implications politically, it poses a very serious question for a democratic government. That is, the government is supposedly the apparatus of the people. It makes laws and regulations in the interests of the public. If you admit a public interest defense into a criminal prosecution, then you're flipping the conflict and posing the question to the public that it's possible their government is guilty of a crime and the person represented as a criminal is actually acting in the public interest. So that a public interest defense can, in this larger sense, represent a fundamental challenge to a government that presents itself as democratic or as a democracy, and it throws into question whether the government is what it claims to be. And I think the case of Edward Snowden really highlighted that very, very dramatically.
V, thanks for bringing to the bear on the particular examples of the lives of whistleblowers, the importance of the discussion about public interest. Lisa, let me turn to you in New York. I know that you need to be leaving shortly, and I wondered if you had any questions for us or if anybody in New York had any questions.
Let's see around the table if anyone wants to jump in here. This is from Human Rights Watch.
Hi, Henry Thatcher from Human Rights Watch. I just wondered if you could touch on the retroactive classification of documents and how that's being used to, again, criminalize whistleblowing because it's then classified.
Great. Thanks. I think I'll turn that to Bill. And I think the next round of questions broadly are looking at ways in which the public interest is recognized in U.S. law, how it could be more recognized in U.S. law, both in declassification and classification decisions, and also possibilities, perhaps, for bringing it into some kind of a defense. So, Bill, if you'll respond to the question about retroactive classification as well as to creative uses of the public interest.
Sure. With respect to retroactive classification, in a sense, that was probably something that was a key element, at least from my perspective, in the Thomas Drake prosecution. In that instance, I served as an expert consultant for the defense and was prepared to serve as an expert witness had it gone to trial. One of the items that Thomas Drake was accused of being criminally in possession of, and in fact served as the first count of his felony indictment, was an email that FBI agents found in his basement. It's an email that was in a trove of unclassified material that Thomas Drake had compiled when he was cooperating with the DODIG in terms of his whistleblower complaint. The email had absolutely no classification markings on it whatsoever, but after it had been confiscated from Drake's possession and subjected to review by the NSA, the government then asserted that it was in fact classified and, as I said, served as the first count for his felony indictment. I was perfectly prepared to testify to a group of 12 peers of Thomas Drake that they could just use their common sense and read that email and see that there was absolutely positively nothing within that document that could be used to harm the national security. And in fact, if you're interested, you could see it yourself. It's on Steve Apgood's website. He submitted a FOIA request after the trial, and it is in fact been acknowledged by the government, at least at this point in time, to be unclassified. So you could read yourself and come to your own conclusion. Nonetheless, I was so taken aback by the government's actions in this case. I had since been retired that I went so far as to seek release from my secrecy confidentiality agreement in terms of accessing evidence as an expert consultant, and the judge granted that so that I could file an official complaint with my former office. And after reviewing the matter for well over a year, my former office came to the conclusion that, well, we all have differences of opinion, and this is nothing more than just a difference of opinion. So I remain very much still troubled by this fact. Believe me, when I retired from the federal government, I in no make, shape, or form intended to embark on even a part-time career of defending individuals accused of mishandling classified. As a matter of fact, the first time I was asked to do that, I told the defense attorney, "You got the wrong guy. You don't understand what I've done for my entire career." But I've been involved in three instances now, and that's exactly what the government has done in those three instances. They have abused their classification authority, in essence, to deny due process to individuals that they accused of crimes. And to this day, if you ask a very simple question, if you look at the executive order treats improper disclosures of classified information and improper classification of information that shouldn't be classified in the first place, it treats them equally as egregious acts subject to the same administrative sanctions that's provided for in the executive order. There's no distinction between the two. As a matter of fact, they're contained in the same prohibition. And yet, if you ask the question, how many individuals have been held accountable by the government for improperly handling or disclosing classified information, you know, the number is countless because it's in the thousands, tens of thousands, who knows. If you ask the question, how many people have been held accountable within the government for improperly classifying information in the first place or asserting that information was classified when it really wasn't, the answer is incalculable. And the reason it's incalculable is because the answer is zero. And so, as far as I'm concerned, that's the first question that any defense attorney should ever ask a government witness who gets on a stand and asserts that this information is classified and could damage the national security, is to simply ask that question. Well, can you tell me how many times has the government ever sanctioned someone for improperly making that assertion? And when the person has to truthfully answer, never, that, in my mind, significantly undermines the credibility of a classification marking in the first place. Which is, quite frankly, the reason why I have gotten involved in those three cases. Not because I was focusing on the individual. I was actually focusing on the integrity of the classification process. And as far as I was concerned, the government was identifying what I fervently believe is a critical national security tool required to keep this nation safe. But by the government's own actions, it has repeatedly undermined the ability of the system to do that. And with regard to the larger question, you know, in terms of the public interest and the political context and whatever, I agree with Sandy that there is really no appetite for that within this country and more specifically within the Congress and what have you. And I think to look at that, we have to look no further than the recent debate over the classification of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence report on the CIA interrogation program, i.e. the torture report. And there was back and forth for years over the classification of information associated with that. And one of the things that was never discussed, and a hat tip to Bert Wy, who's in the audience here, who reminded me of this, is that the Senate actually always had the unilateral authority on its own to release any information from that report that they deemed appropriate. Because back in 1974, when the Senate initially established the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, in the basic rule that established that committee, and this is a quote, that the committee may disclose publicly any information in its possession after the committee determines that the public interest would be served by such disclosure. And then it included provisions requiring action by the full Senate should the president object. That was never even discussed during the time. And the reason why is because there's been this history, especially since 9/11, but even predates that, in terms of our two co-equal branches of government, the judiciary and the legislature. They unfortunately genuflect, from my perspective, at the altar of national security, and they defer to the executive in this regard. Which, when you think about it, as Bay said, there's, you know, power and secrecy is the recipe for corruption. And, you know, yes, the executive should have the ability to define and interpret the laws in terms of what the president's authorities are and things along those lines. But yet our system of government is very clear. That ability to interpret the laws and define his authority as president is circumscribed by our two other co-equal branches of government, the courts and the Congress, to limit that. But of course, for the other two branches to exercise that authority, they have to know what the executive is asserting in the first place. And they can't do that, as we've seen in the CIA interrogation, as we've seen in wireless wiretaps and whatever. They can't do that when the executive unilaterally determines that that it's secret. But yet, nonetheless, even with this history, and even with the most ardent critics we saw over the, this most recent report, the CISI was, there was never even discussion of exercising this so-called nuclear option that they had all along. Great. Leave it at that.
More comments.
Let me just say,
I'll take more, and then Lisa, I'll get back to you.
I'll be very sure. Contrary to what is widely believed, there is no crime in the United States of revealing classified information. There simply isn't any such crime in the books. There is a crime which is called espionage, which is about espionage, but it refers to information relating to the national defense. There's no crime of revealing classified information. And I think it is, was clear to the government when they finally looked. I was also a consultant to the defense in the Drake case and was about to testify. And I believe that count would have been thrown out because it is—it can't be a crime to reveal information that the government has already made public and that it's failed to declassify. And there is case law that that supports that. It is an example, and we have many others, of the abuse by the government of the criminal laws that do exist in order to try to intimidate people not to release information that they don't want to disclose.
Lisa,
did
you have a follow-up question?
Yeah, I just wanted to raise the question, and maybe this is a difficult one to answer because it could be all of the above, but I mean, if we're looking at all these different elements, there's the whistleblower protections and how to strengthen that, there's the potential power in Congress to make public information in the public interest, there's ideas about how to strengthen the defenses available to people who are charged with some kind of crime in relation to revealing secrets, and then there's the pressure on government to classify fewer documents as secret or to provide more appeals to challenge those decisions. But where do we look to really see some change, and what is the, you know, is there a best hope for how to see, if you're thinking about this from a human rights angle, how to see that we can know sooner and know more about what the government may be trying to cover up because these are embarrassing or because these are acts of malfeasance on the part of government officials. How can we best move that agenda forward with this array of problems and fairly unsuccessful solutions, if we could say. There's no clear path to me. So I'm just curious what people see as the way to make a real change in the United States.
So,
I think the answer is an all of the above answer. I mean, we have to try all of the things we are trying. But I think there are some approaches that have been tried less, that have been less fully exploited than others. Certainly, Snowden broke the rules to tremendous effect. The reverberations of his actions are still propagating through the system in interesting ways. Others are challenging the system in presenting frontal challenges through Freedom of Information Act lawsuits and other forms of what you might call confrontational approaches. The third kind of basket of approaches that I think has been less fully exploited is a kind of insider approach that attempts to work within the system to loosen it up and to free it up. There's actually a tremendous amount of ferment within the within the national security bureaucracy right now that you would miss if you think that, everybody's a little Nixon or a little Dick Cheney. Because they're not. They're actually people who are thinking hard about these issues, who want to be regarded as public servants, and who see themselves as such. So what am I talking about? The latest report of the Information Security Oversight Office noted that there were 813 classification challenges last year brought by authorized holders of classified information. In other words, these were not Freedom of Information Act requesters, these were not civil society people, these were people within the system who already had access who said, wait a minute, this stuff is classified and it shouldn't be. That's a very high number, and it's much higher than it has been in the past. Of the 813 challenges, 453 of them were granted in whole or in part, or slightly more than half. That's a phenomenon that we don't really understand or appreciate. I mentioned earlier the executive order only mentions the public interest, the executive order on classification only mentions the public interest in one passage. It doesn't say anything about including the public interest in classifying when you're classifying information. But the intelligence community issued a statement of principles on transparency last February, and they actually said that you should consider the public interest to the maximum extent feasible when making classification determinations. That goes beyond what the executive order says. There's no such requirement in the executive order. Now, it's not legally enforceable. It's not something that someone can say, well, we expect, you know, we demand that you do this. But it is a reflection of a genuine soul-searching that's going on within the executive branch. I think it is part of the response to Snowden, which has gone in two directions. One is improve security so there can't be any more Snowdens. That's the insider threat approach, where they're monitoring people, monitoring their activities, and so on. The other is the what can we do to increase transparency? And there's actually an intelligence community transparency working group that no one has ever heard of, because they're not public facing. They're not trying to engage the public. They're trying to figure out what they think is the right way to go on transparency, because they recognize that it is a problem. And I think that is a phenomenon that has potential for people to work with and to take advantage of.
Great.
So I think the intelligence community is now far ahead of the rest of the government in its interest in and commitment to trying to figure out how to declassify more. And I think that the president has pushed them very hard, but there really is. Again, I would suggest two things, and Bill, and what's already been said. The passage in the executive order on declassification and taking account of the public interest not only does not apply to classification, but it's also written in a convoluted form for the purpose of keeping it from being subject to judicial review when requests are made under the Freedom of Information Act. And that was not an accident. It was done intentionally for that. So what needs to be done is to pull that provision out, make it a requirement for both classification and declassification, but an actual requirement of the classification order, and then it would become subject to Freedom of Information Act requests, and judges could then make a decision as to whether so judges would not have to overrule the government on whether something would cause harm, which is what they now have to do. They would be able to do the balancing test and say this should be made public because the public interest is greater. And it would be a relatively small change consistent with what the intelligence community is saying. And the other thing is to take the provision in the executive order which says you can't classify things for the purpose of covering up embarrassment and crime, and just change the words to say if rather than for the purpose of, because that's what everybody thinks it means. People say, well, you can't cover up crimes, and it's no, you can only cover up if that's the purpose. And of course, if you ask the classifier, he said, no, I cover it up because if we reveal that we tortured people, people will riot outside embassies. And so the provision doesn't really say what everybody thinks it says. So I would make those two changes.
Can I just ask to clarify,
are you talking about more changes in the executive order language,
right?
Or do you think,
changes in the executive order then become changes in the Freedom of Information Act, because the Freedom of Information Act says information properly classified pursuant to an executive order. So it then gives the court the ability to say, this is torture, it has to be public, the public interest overrides here, it should be made public.
The political difficulty is you're asking the executive branch to lower its shield, say, remove this shield against litigation. And it's not clear under what circumstances they would ever do it. They might do it in the Mort Halperin administration, but I don't think, you know, I don't know who else would do it.
And that's why, from my perspective, it needs to be legislator based. You know, that Congress needs to do it. You know, getting to my fundamental point that, you know, judges, the courts and the Congress need to be much more assertive in this area. They can't be as deferential. You know, from a congressional point of view, there is a precedent already embedded in statute. We're all familiar with the JFK assassination records. Act that was passed back in the 1990s, and that actually has a higher standard for continued classification than the executive order, and it's based in law, and it can be just as applicable to original classifications and decisions. And it says specifically, it says that all these records must be fully disclosed unless, number one, continued classification is necessary by identifiable harm to the military defense, intelligence operations, etc. And two, the identifiable harm is of such gravity that it outweighs the public interest in disclosure. And that's a basis in law right now. And that's just one example of how, you know, if there was an assertive Congress in this area, you know, things could be done.
Great.
Bert
Wise and Ian, can you take the microphone to you? And please identify yourself.
Bert Wise, just a pro bono advocate, but I've worked in this area in the executive and in the legislature. One, just a quick point on the provision that Bill referenced, allowing the intelligence committees. There's an identical one in both the House and Senate resolutions creating them, which Mort played a big role, along with some of us on the church committee, in getting put in. And that is that when I alerted the media to that, they all, the ones I knew, wrote back, well, it's nice in theory, would never happen. And the fact is that when Carter, quote, gave away the Panama Canal, there was such a firestorm that the Republicans on the committee were able to get a majority in the committee and in the Senate, utilizing that provision to make public stuff that the administration insisted was far too sensitive. And on the committee, in fact, eventually at least Wyden and some of the others were aware of it. I think with the leadership on the Democratic side and in general, they didn't think they had the votes, so they tried to use it as leverage for the bargaining over what could be done. But going back to Mort, and I probably, this is an act that makes me certifiable to question Mort, but I would disagree with you on FOIA, because in 1974 or so, Phil Hart, when I was his counsel, got an amendment to FOIA, to the National Security Exemption. It is still the law, and it says that if there is an appeal in court, the judge is to make a de novo determination balancing the security threat claimed by the executive against not the public interest but the purpose of FOIA, which is very close. Unfortunately, in the statement of managers of the conference, which is the equivalent of the committee report, they slipped in words about deference to the executive agency's expertise. So except for a few of the younger judges, in rare occasions, it's been a dead letter, but actually it's there for defense attorneys who know about it and argue it and are lucky enough to get a judge willing to be responsible on it. But I had a question, and that is the following. With regard to the appeals that go up and the percentages where they say, gee whiz, Bill, that you, can it eventually from the mandatory declassification review go to court? And if so, there's no basis for that.
No, as a matter of fact, and maybe Steve can fill me in on the blanks, just the opposite. If the issue had been subject to a FOIA request and court decision, what, 2 years prior?
Yes.
That the panel wouldn't even consider it. It wouldn't even be considered for ripe or reconsideration. So they are totally separate and distinct. And because what that panel is doing is fundamentally, the panel is exercising the ultimate prerogative of the president. He's a busy man. He can't entertain these requests, so he's delegated to this interagency panel to exercise his prerogative as commander-in-chief.
So then would have to flip over to a FOIA request.
Right. Well, the only additional appeal after that is a member agency head, the head of a member agency, can appeal directly to the president to overrule a panel decision. And that was done once, and it took about 4 or 5 years for that overruling to take place. It took a change in administrations, and it took a lot of other stuff.
And the other thing quickly, which I wondered if anyone could discuss, the one area where Obama has clearly been worse than his predecessor is regarding the abuse of the State Secrets Act to block any litigation with regard to matters on the grounds that even to entertain the suit would harm national security, which to me has been used by him outrageously in a way that cuts across all of the reforms that you're talking about. I wonder if anyone could comment on that.
Yeah, I mean, in that case, you know, there was so-called reforms announced by Eric Holder and what have you, but if you take a look at some of the most recent cases, there was a case, I guess, a year or so ago out in California, a PhD student at Stanford, I believe, who was placed on a no-fly list. The government attempted to preclude it from going to getting judicial relief from this. This is a classic example where you need assertive judges, because as it turned out, the state secret that the government is attempting to protect in that case was that the FBI agent checked the wrong box, and he meant to check another box, and that was the state secret that was being protected. And it was an assertive judge who made the decision over the government's objection to release that, the statement of facts that came out of that case.
A couple points. First, I think by far worse even than the state secrets privilege is the Obama administration using the criminal statutes against people who disclose information. They've done now, I think, 8 or 9. Every other president combined did 3. On the state secrets privilege, Bush administration started it. Obama promised us he would reform it, and instead he's gone far worse in the other direction. So I think it is true. On the Freedom of Information Act...
Excuse me, we cannot hear too much in New York, actually.
Oh.
Oops. Sorry, I keep turning my mic off.
Let's go out.
Thanks. On the Freedom of Information Act, you're right that judges refuse to do what the law tells them to do, which is to make a de novo review. But the de novo review they're supposed to make is whether the information was properly classified. And therefore, you have to look at the executive order, which says the only thing you can look at is harm. So a judge now has to say, I disagree with the government's assertion that the release of this could reasonably be expected to cause harm to the national security. If you amend the executive order in the way we suggested, then the judge could go on to say, I accept the government's harm, but it is outweighed by the public value of the information. And I believe judges are much more likely to do that than to second-guess the government on the harm, even though the statute tells them they're supposed to.
I'd like to take a few more questions from the audience. Kate, and please identify yourself.
Hi, I'm Kate Martin from the Center for National Security Studies, and I have a question for those of you who worked in this field for a long time to follow up on Lisa's question, which is, what is your overall view about how much information the American public actually learns in a timely fashion about what our government is up to on national security matters. And because it seems to me that there's two different things going on. One is, if you look at the press reporting on what the U.S. government's done since 2001, it's extraordinary. What took a long time was to get official acknowledgement that the press reports were correct sometimes. But I guess my question is, do you think that there are terrible secrets that are being withheld that, you know, to a greater extent than has been true, you know, in the last 50 years?
I just think that the American people get as much information as they demand. I mean, it's as simple as that. They don't demand enough. And that's the environment we're in. And so, and it's not so much, from my perspective, it's not so much how many additional ugly secrets are there out there. It's to what extent do we have an environment that is conducive to producing those ugly secrets? Whether it's through criminal intent or whether it's just through malfeasance. I mean, the perfect example I give is, you know, from a national security point of view, just compare the rhetoric that we hear from our government in terms of condemning the Snowden leaks and listen to what we hear from the government in terms of the OPM hack. That OPM hack, you know, from my perspective, you take every espionage case that's been involved in this country against this government, all the damage that's occurred because of them, in the history of the Republic, and multiply it by a factor of 10, 100, 1,000, I don't know. Maybe you'll begin to approach the implications to national security because of that OPM hack. Compare the government's rhetoric to what's come out of that to Snowden.
I thought you were going to ask a slightly different question about how the public processes information. I think we do have a problem that is even larger than secrecy, and that is our ability to digest and deliberate over information. If you imagine that the secrecy problem was suddenly solved, I think we would still have political problems as a society in the way that we deliberate over information. If you look at, you know, totally unclassified issues, whether it's healthcare or tax policy or education, there's something broken in our deliberative process that is independent of secrecy and is probably even harder to solve.
I hope you're going to say something more cheerful.
Christine, I'll take your comment, and I'd like to hear from Anna and a round of closing comments. Christina.
Thank you for a very interesting panel. Two very little questions. One, the ICRC conducts missions on the basis of confidentiality. But in the past, the state used to be able to release reports if it so decided. The U.S. doesn't, and somehow now the ICRC says it cannot release them, even if the U.S. government were willing to release them. Are these mechanisms of declassification useful for trying to get ICRC reports by any chance? Has anybody tried? Is anybody doing that?
So, interesting suggestion. Something to note. I only know that they are subject to confidentiality by agreement, but I think that ICRC does go public on occasion when they feel that the agreement with the host country has been breached.
I think there are only cases of ICRC delegates who have done that at risk to their own job. But anyway, the second question was...
Unfortunately, I think the answer to the first question is no. That because they're associated with their non-U.S. government information, it's considered presumptively classified. And so you can't force the issue. What you can try to do is to elicit a voluntary disclosure, either working through members of Congress or directly through the administration. But the legal tools, as they exist, can't be used to compel disclosure right now.
And the second small question is about the PACE resolution that you began the session with. that I understood you to say that it now encourages states to offer asylum to whistleblowers. And has any other state other than Russia offered Snowden asylum, or has anything happened as a result of that resolution?
So, Anna, I'd like to turn it back to you, unless anybody has a specific answer. As far as we know, I don't think any other country has, but Anna, let's hear from you. And if you have any concluding comments.
I'll combine them. I guess a couple of things. One is that I found myself nodding a lot to what Bill has been saying, and particularly when he said, even though he and I work very closely with individual whistleblowers and have for many years in different parts of the world. We're doing it because they reveal information that I want to know, and that as a public member of the public, I should have probably known, or the fact that they have to tell me means that there's a real problem with the accountability mechanism. So it is because of the information that they are having to report either internally or to a government agency or more widely. And I think there's much more acceptance, at least in Europe. And I put this in, it's coming at it from a different point of view. There's a different debate. There's times in which we would look to the US and say, oh my God, they're doing things and we're just talking. So there's looking across both the sides of the Atlantic, and there is different pushes. And I think what's creative about this discussion across the Atlantic is how we can sort of start to talk about this. But I think that whistleblowing is meant to be, and whistleblowers are meant to be, a last resort. And right now, we're finding around the world that they're like the only resort. And if what you're saying is that there aren't the accountability mechanisms or deference is too high to any bit of our government, and our government and our system doesn't rely just on the executive, it doesn't rely just on the legislative branch, doesn't rely just on the courts. It is a balance between those. And when that balance is tipped in a direction that is overly deferential, and I would say in the UK probably there's over-deference to national security, not necessarily to the executive, then you've got a problem. And I think one of the things that we're all picking up on, and which is making the debates much more interesting, is actually, why are we waiting for these people, and why are we putting them in that position? Because what we're seeing more and more of is more whistleblowers come forward, even despite clearly facing some very, very difficult situations, and perhaps the reaction is even stronger than it used to be, but what they're starting to feel, a lot of them, is that there is more public support, because the balance seems to have tipped far beyond what any of us thought was happening, or would like to have happened. So I think that in terms of the no sooner, no more, I think there is a change in the mood music, and Snowden helped push that. For those of us working in the Whistleblower Protection Committee, Snowden at the very first glance was like, oh my God, we're trying to normalize whistleblowing, make all the other mechanisms work, and here's someone in national security, and there's people who will work in a local authority or a local hospital who will say, that's not me. But what in fact has happened is the way he's done it, and the fact that people are focusing on the information and the accountability mechanisms, it means there's a much longer tail than the actual individual whistleblower. And I think that's one of the things that we need to pick up on is we want our accountability mechanisms to work. And we want them to work because we demand them to work, and we don't just want to rely on whistleblowers. It just is starting to feel very deeply unfair on a whole series of levels, which means whistleblowing is being picked up in the national security area, it's being picked up in the open government area, it's being picked up in the anti-corruption field, it's being picked up in the journalist sources, much more, and it's being seen as linked to all of that in a way that probably those at GAP and those at Public Concern at Work have been seeing it all along, because it was always about the public interest. And that would be what I would say.
Thanks, Anna. B, concluding thoughts?
I just wanted to follow up a little bit about on what Anna was saying, that part of why whistleblowing has moved center stage, I think, is because in the United States, in the UK, and around the world, there has been this deregulation of authorities, so that and we saw it in the United States beginning under Reagan, where essential services were privatized and regulation of them was also privatized, so that the public is no longer a factor in, say, the regulation of an essential service. So, for example, in water services, there used to be a regulator who had state resources, state power, etc., to make sure that rates were not summarily raised, that pressure was maintained, etc. And that's gone. It's gone in sector after sector, and we're seeing the consequence. We saw the consequence of that in the financial meltdown of 2008. And what that's done is put this huge burden on individual whistleblowers, and that is such a desperate imbalance of power if an individual has to confront a corporation or a federal agency. They are going to lose regardless of what the law says, and so we're already, when we're talking about whistleblower defense, on our back feet, and we need to start moving back toward public sector responsibility for public sector services, I think, equalizing. It comes back to this balance of power. That having said that, the fact is what we have still are whistleblowers, and so we need to strengthen protections around them. And I just did want to say one thing in response to Kate's question and Steve's answer. Are there terrible secrets still out there that we don't know? It's a very kind of creepy feeling, because you know, Snowden, for example, and whistleblowers generally say their most, their worst fear after going through what they go through is that nothing will change, because what they regarded as a terrible secret, the public does not regard as a terrible secret. So you kind of have to define terrible. The gifted whistleblower is the person who knows how to make the public realize this is really terrible. So, for example, I'll wrap up with this, that we know, for example, that force feeding is going on at Guantanamo. But when you read that phrase, it doesn't really horrify you. But the government is trying to conceal the videotapes of what that looks like. And the question is, if we saw that, would we react to it? Would we want that to stop? Would we think that that was something the government should not do? So there are so many nuances to this. If we have a whistleblower who comes out of the force feeding room and says, you know, that was really terrible, that may be the closest we're going to get to knowing what the government's doing, in the absence of a structure that represents the public interest as part of the state. And someone did say once, you know, you can deregulate with a stroke of a pen, but it takes years and years to rebuild a regulatory structure. And so we have whistleblowers.
Thank you. Well, I'll open for final comments, but I put together a list of at least 6 recommendations that have been made. One is to more creative use of the defense of necessity. 2 is sanctions for overclassification. 3, the insider approach, which could include encouraging more insider challenges to overclassification being brought to the ISU. 4, recognition that the House and Senate Select Committees have discretion to disclose even classified information in the public interest. 5, the executive order on classification should be amended to make consideration of public interest applicable to classification decisions as well as to declassification. That would enable incorporation into the FOIA and consideration of a balancing of harm versus public interest rather than just harm. And 6, the executive order should be amended
to prohibit the withholding of information if the if withholding would conceal a crime or other misconduct or other bad acts. I hope I got those right. Any additions? Any final comments, Steve?
I don't have concluding remarks, but I do have something new that I just learned. If you had asked me how many whistleblowers there were in the Department of Defense in a recent six-month period, I would have said, I don't know, I would guess dozens, maybe hundreds. But in the latest report of the DoD Inspector General, they say that they received 5,932 hotline complaints of waste, fraud, and abuse, which is, just strikes me as an extraordinarily high number. Not only that, but they also received 617 whistleblower reprisal complaints. In other words, approximately 10% of the number of people who were complaining about waste, fraud, and abuse said that they suffered reprisal as a result. And the Inspector General didn't validate all of those, but said that 15% of those 600 were, in fact, verifiably reprised against. So this is a turbulent and extremely important area that I think can only benefit from our attention and support.
Thank you. Bill?
Like I said, the only final point I would make is just a reiteration, and that is the fact that, you know, again, I'm a firm believer in the criticality of classification as a national security tool to keep the nation safe and things along those lines. But I am truly, truly concerned for its inability to be self-correcting when it comes to deliberate abuses by either individuals or agencies and things along those lines. And until it can become self-correcting, you know, I truly believe in, you know, especially since this is a process rooted in executive order, that it is going to require forces outside the executive branch, be it the Congress, be it the courts, to impose some self-correction on the system until it proves its capability to do it itself.
Mark? Okay, those are the last words. Thank you all. Thanks very much to our panel.
Thanks very much, Amy.